funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Authorities in Pakistan are dealing with an attack on an Air Force bus this morning that killed 13 people and wounded 11 others. The Taliban are claiming responsibility in retaliation for Pakistani airstrikes on a Taliban stronghold near the Afghan border. The attack is sadly emblematic of the violence gripping much of Pakistan these days, and that loss of control bodes nearly as badly for Afghanistan, which shares hundreds of miles of unguarded border with its neighbor to the east, and remains a hot target for terrorists who then retreat back to Pakistan and find easy hiding places. So what is likely to happen next, and can the violence be controlled on one side of the border if the other remains in chaos? David Gartenstein-Ross is Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. He has just published an essay in the Weekly Standard magazine called A Dangerous Neighbor, How Pakistan's Deterioration Harms Afghanistan. David, welcome back to Think.
Thanks, Chris. It's always great to join you.
These two countries have a lot of problems in common, and they have a lot of conflict between them. Can you give us an overview, David, of how they have arrived at the current relationship?
Yes, I think the best place to go back to is the U.S. action shortly after 9/11, when one of the first priorities that the U.S. had following those terrorist attacks was to topple the Taliban in Afghanistan, which was at the time providing safe harbor to al-Qaeda. Following the ouster of the Taliban from power, most al-Qaeda senior leaders fled across the border from Afghanistan into Pakistan's tribal areas. That is, mountainous regions that are difficult to patrol, where the tribes have a lot of power that is divorced from the central government. Al-Qaeda's senior leadership went about there establishing themselves within the tribal structure. There were some intermarriages that were beneficial to them, and they really tried to embed themselves into the tribal structure that prevailed. As they gained power, they sought to show that they were back in business, for example, by trying to assassinate Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf on multiple occasions. In response, Musharraf mobilized his troops and tried to flush al-Qaeda out of the tribal areas, but found that they were putting up very stiff resistance, along with tribes and the Taliban that had allied with them. As a result, by 2006, Musharraf felt that he had no choice but to enter into a series of accords with militants in the tribal areas, the first of which were called the Waziristan Accords, that were finally consummated in September 2006. But there have been a lot of accords since then, which have the effect of helping to formalize a safe haven where al-Qaeda and the Taliban are able to enjoy relative power. You have, for example, a remarkable travelogue published in the Pakistani press recently in which a Pakistani journalist traveled to the country's Khyber agency and found that within that agency, not only were the Taliban imposing their own very strict version of Sharia law on the ground, but they were even going house to house and making families give them one male, basically as a form of conscription into military service. There's been an increase in terrorist training camps, and all of that is felt across the border in Afghanistan, where you not only have people launching cross-border attacks from Pakistan, people who are very much well-prepared for the fight, either because they have already gotten combat experience engaged against the Pakistani military or because they're graduates of one of the training camps there. There are other problems as well that are posed both to the Afghan government and also to coalition forces that are trying to protect that government, including the fact that this gives al-Qaeda and the Taliban essentially a virtually untouchable rear guard because the U.S. Can't undertake, and nor can coalition forces undertake a major incursion into Pakistan's sovereign territory. As a result, there's always this area where militants who are fighting coalition forces in Afghanistan can go to regroup, to train, and to prepare themselves to continue the fight.
And to be clear here, when Musharraf functionally gave Waziristan to the Taliban and al-Qaeda, he got some sort of promises from them that they would stop the violence to a certain extent, and there's no way to enforce that, and in fact, it hasn't happened that way at all.
Right, that's correct. And at the time, for example, Musharraf had a press conference with President Bush. He was in Washington, D.C. around the time the Waziristan Accords were signed. And Bush, quite infamously, at least within counterterrorism circles, said, you know, I believe him when it comes to the Waziristan Accords. He said, when Musharraf looks me in the eye and tells me that the Taliban, al-Qaeda won't be there, I have to believe him. It didn't turn out that way. And as you correctly point out, Chris, part of what the Pakistani government got was unenforceable promises that they wouldn't carry out attacks, But the looking at those treaties, at the time I was saying that the treaties would fail. And they have indeed. And all you have to do is look at it to see what the Pakistani government gives up, giving up the right to carry out airstrikes or ground strikes in those tribal territories, and also agreeing to disband its human intelligence networks, versus unenforceable promises. And this doesn't bode well for some of the other agreements that Pakistan has subsequently made. The way Pakistan tries to frame it, they frame these as being treaties with the tribes in order to drive out the Taliban and al-Qaeda. But looking at the text of the treaties as they've come out in the Pakistani press, as they've been explained in the Pakistani press, there's no reason to believe that the latest treaties that Pakistan has entered into are any different. Now, the problem is, and I recently spoke to a very high-ranking military officer who is serving in Afghanistan, there is a coalescing view within the U.S. military that you can't win Afghanistan unless you can win Pakistan. That is, unless you can come up with a coherent and sane policy to deal with the fact that there's a safe haven that our enemies in Afghanistan are able to operate from. And right now, the U.S. government does not have such a policy to deal with this safe haven.
David Gartenstein-Ross is my guest. He is Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. His article in the Weekly Standard is called A Dangerous Neighbor, How Pakistan's Deterioration Harms Afghanistan. So we have spent in the U.S. over $12 billion in Pakistan for military aid since 9/11. It's pretty clear that it's not working as it's being applied now against the insurgency. Is that money, do you think, buying us any benefits at all?
I wouldn't say that it's buying us no benefits. I don't think that the $12 billion in aid that we've given is worth $12 billion to us. Look, Pakistan, for all of its faults, is an important ally. It's also a state with nuclear weapons, a Muslim state with nuclear weapons, where there are a lot of concerns that it can tilt in the other direction. That is, a number of people who served in the Carter administration back in the late 1970s, who were there for the Iranian Revolution, have said that Pakistan 2008 looks a lot like Iran 1979. Now, that may be a bit extreme, but we know that al-Qaeda is, that al-Qaeda is popular in the tribal areas and has a lot of supporters in urban areas as well. We know that within the Pakistani military and intelligence services, there are a substantial amount of people who are sympathetic with this jihadist ideology. And when I say substantial, I mean, according to some of my sources within the U.S. intelligence community, about a third of each, about a third in the military, about a third in the intelligence services. The Pakistani ISI is the institution that in the very first instance really propped up the Taliban in the 1990s when Afghanistan was so chaotic. They thought that having a group that was trained in Pakistani madrasas, a group that was ideologically very committed to an extreme form of Islam, would provide Pakistan with a sort of strategic depth. That's the exact phrase that they used, would provide Pakistan with a strategic depth in Afghanistan. So these links are longstanding. They're not links that just cropped up post 9/11. Now, part of the problem with the Bush administration in general is it doesn't do a good job with muscular diplomacy. When it comes to a policy that's somewhere at the midpoint between bombing a country and doing nothing at all, it doesn't do a very good job at finding that midpoint. In Pakistan, one thing that we should have been doing all along, and one thing that the need to do has become much clearer now, but is much harder to do, is to try to cleanse the military and intelligence services of those individuals who are sympathetic with al-Qaeda, sympathetic with the Taliban, and thus working against the Pakistani state. It's much more difficult now because the U.S. has only become more and more unpopular in Pakistan, and things are much more sensitive at this point in time. But coupled with aid, we need to think about how to give it out in a more intelligent manner, both cleansing services of people who are working for the enemy, and also targeting our aid towards people who are loyalist toward the government and ultimately toward the fight against terrorism, such as specific units that have done a good job of engaging the enemy. There are ways to target our aid much more effectively.
You mentioned the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, which is ostensibly benefiting from a lot of that military aid that the U.S. is giving out. The United States has found that, has concluded that the ISI was responsible for bombing the Indian embassy in Kabul last month. India is also an important U.S. ally. At what point does the Bush administration need to stop backing the Musharraf administration?
Well, it's important to understand what it means. when one says that the ISI was responsible for that bombing. It's not that the ISI as an institution implemented that as an institutional policy, but rather that there are factions within the ISI that was responsible for bombing the Indian embassy. And the reason why that distinction is important, look, Pakistan is not like the United States. When we think of the U.S., if something happens and is done by the intelligence services or is done by the military, now maybe there's an instance in which a patrol acted, acted in a rogue way. But for a major operation, you're not going to have a major U.S. operation that is simply unknown by the chain of command. Pakistan, on the other hand, often functions much more like a banana republic, to be very frank about it. For example, as your listeners hopefully know, Musharraf came to power in the first instance in a military coup. Now, the person he deposed was Nawaz Sharif, who's a figure who's back on the Pakistani political scene and is actually very concerning because of some of his policies towards al-Qaeda and the Taliban. But leaving that aside, one of the reasons that there was tension in the late 1990s between Musharraf and Nawaz Sharif is because Musharraf, who was the head of the military at the time, launched a major military incursion against India into Kashmir without without the president, without Nawaz Sharif having any knowledge that this was coming. And that I think gives a little bit of an indication as to how things occur in Pakistan. And when it comes to the bombing of the Indian embassy, I've talked to a lot of U.S. intelligence sources about this, and nobody thinks that this was an official ISI policy. Rather, it's one more indication of how heavily infiltrated the ISI is. I think that the U.S. needs to maintain a strong relationship with Pakistan, but as I said, it needs to be much more muscular in its diplomacy. You can't just back Pakistan unconditionally. Rather, you have to be frank about the problems that are there. One good sign is that in recent weeks, at the very end of July, the deputy director of the CIA went over to Pakistan with a dossier which outlines the links between the ISI and militants in the Pakistani tribal regions who are fighting against coalition forces in Afghanistan. What this signals, albeit subtly, is that the U.S. is becoming more direct about the problems in Pakistan. Now, we can't be very loud about it. As I said, the U.S. is extremely unpopular in Pakistan, and if we're too loud about the problems there, we risk putting Pakistani politicians in an untenable situation where they undermine their own base of support by doing the right thing. But behind the scenes, quietly and persistently, we need to apply pressure to the very real problems in that country.
What's the most appropriate kind of pressure?
I think that the pressure should involve U.S. aid. We provided a substantial amount of aid to Pakistan, U.S. military assistance, and also one additional kind of pressure is, you mentioned India before. Obviously, there's a substantial conflict between India and Pakistan involving primarily the Kashmir region. I think that we can leverage that to the greatest extent by, on the one hand, threatening to tilt much more towards India, which is the world's largest democracy and a country that, when it comes to the war on terror, understands the problem of militant Islam and has experienced terrorist attacks in its own country and is dedicated to trying to combat this problem. We can threaten to tilt more towards India, while on the other hand, holding out a carrot of trying to make more international more of an international issue of Kashmir and trying to resolve that conflict.
David Gartenstein-Ross is my guest. He's Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. His article in the Weekly Standard is called A Dangerous Neighbor, How Pakistan's Deterioration Harms Afghanistan. You can find it online if you want to read it. If you want to join our conversation, you can call right now, 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking about an article in the Weekly Standard magazine called A Dangerous Neighbor, How Pakistan's Deterioration Harms Afghanistan. The author is with us this afternoon. It's David Gartenstein-Ross. He's Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call now, 1-800-933-5372, or send an email to think@kera.org. Let's talk for a minute about the impact of soft diplomacy. You had, a month ago now, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee proposing not to cut any aid to Pakistan, but instead to increase aid for things like infrastructure and education and medical clinics in order to sort of build the country up and give it power against terrorist forces. How long do you think it would take for something like this to really be effective, given the volatility of the situation as it stands right now?
That's an excellent question, and I'm just not sure how long it would take. Certainly, one of the assumptions that's proceeding from is that part of the problem is poverty, and you know, poverty often can definitely contribute to the rise of extremist movements. Poverty and lack of the rule of law. We could see that in Somalia, for example, a country that experienced 13 years of anarchy prior to 2006. Where the Islamic Courts Union, an Islamist group with ties to al-Qaeda, came to power, helped to improve the economy only marginally, but actually provided some sort of stability for the first time in a long time. Despite their brutal rule, they certainly seemed better than the anarchy and the fear of going out at night that previously had prevailed in Somalia. But at the same time, sometimes people can overplay the role of poverty. There have been multiple studies that have been done on this in terms of the profile of terrorists, most notably Mark Sageman's book, Understanding Terror Networks, actually looking at people who are involved in terrorist groups. And Sageman found in his study that there's not a correlation between poverty and someone's involvement in a terrorist organization or in terrorist plots. There certainly is merit to providing infrastructural aid to a country like Pakistan, which is in need of it. But we shouldn't overplay what the strategic benefits will be to us.
Things obviously changed politically a great deal in February after the elections in Pakistan. A new parliament came in, very anti-Musharraf, certainly anti-U.S. Now, Musharraf has the power legally, even having given up power of control of the military. He could disband parliament. What do you think are the chances that he would do something like that?
Well, Musharraf certainly seems to be clinging to power with every last dying breath of his. I mean, a military contact of mine who I spoke to last night about this described him as being like a James Bond villain. How at the end of a James Bond movie, the villain will hit the self-destruct button, even though he knows that it means his own doom. And the reason he made that analogy, silly though the analogy may be, is that it seems that if things come up to a vote in the National Assembly and Senate, that the opposition parties do have enough votes to impeach Musharraf, something that they are certainly on the road to doing. Now, Musharraf has a few options, one of which is the option that you mentioned, which is he can dissolve Parliament and declare a state of emergency. If he's to do that, what he would require is the backing of the military. Now, he appointed the new Army Chief of Staff, General Kiani, following Musharraf himself stepping down as the Army Chief of Staff. He's close to Kiani. Kiani is known as a Musharraf loyalist. But there are three possibilities as to what could happen if he tries to dissolve the parliament. One is that Musharraf declares a state of emergency and nobody stands behind Musharraf. Obviously, that would be devastating to Musharraf. But he could still do some damage on his way out. The second option is that the army stands behind Musharraf declares a state of emergency. Now, the effect of that would be unclear. It's not clear how long he could maintain the state of emergency, given how unpopular Musharraf is in Pakistan. I mean, if your listeners think President Bush is unpopular, Musharraf's unpopularity in Pakistan dwarfs Bush's. And the third option is that he tries to declare a state of emergency, and some of the army stands behind him and some don't, which would create a conflict within the armed forces themselves. Either way, the clear beneficiary of all this political chaos is the militants in the country, al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and the like, because they get to watch as their own adversaries battle each other. Either way, in terms of U.S. interests, our interests in Pakistan, none of them are being served by this political chaos.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're talking to David Gartenstein-Ross about his article, A Dangerous Neighbor, How Pakistan's Deterioration Harms Afghanistan. Let's go to Murphy and speak to Shahzad. Hi, Shahzad.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. My question for your guest is, based on the current charge sheet that is being prepared against Musharraf by the coalition partners in the government, and also by the findings of the U.S. Senate and some of the congressional committees, Musharraf embezzled more than half of the U.S. aid. Why does the U.S. still keep backing him?
That's an excellent question. First of all, I do want to say, with respect to the embezzlement charges, the charge sheet hasn't been put forward yet, nor has anything been proven with respect to Musharraf. Now, I'm not saying that Musharraf hasn't been embezzling, but those charges, if you look at the top Pakistani politicians, have been leveled against virtually everybody except for Yusuf Raza Jalani. For example, Nawaz Sharif, accusations dogged him. Asif Ali Zardari in the PPP has definitely been charged with embezzlement and was even indicted for it during the 1990s. So it's one of those things. There are certain countries where you have, you know, at top levels, basically everybody is dogged with corruption charges. Israel is another country where at top levels, basically every major Israeli politician has been hit with those charges, and you have an analogous situation in Pakistan. The main reason that the U.S. has stuck behind Musharraf, and I think it is a short-sighted policy, I've been saying for a couple of years that we needed a policy other than putting our own eggs in the Musharraf basket. But the reason the U.S. has done it is because the prevailing view was, okay, Musharraf is ineffective, but he's still the best thing that we've got, and things could be worse. With Nawaz Sharif, they would be worse. With others, like Jalani and perhaps Zardari, they wouldn't necessarily.
So there's no absolute way to predict whether, if he is impeached and removed from office, whether that might have a stabilizing impact on the country.
Well, look, I certainly don't think that it will be stabilizing in the short term. As I said, I think that this political chaos is bad right now, but I don't see how Musharraf can govern effectively. I'm not saying that the impeachment of Musharraf is a good thing, but honestly, he has been governing for a long time, like a man who is just trying to survive that day. He's had no long-term strategy. In dealing with militants in the tribal areas, he would mobilize the Pakistani military for a few days, talk about how he was going to clear the entire place out, and then within a few days reassert the validity of the treaties that he'd entered into. I've talked to people familiar with his military record, and he was always regarded within the military as being a brilliant tactician but a lousy strategist, and he's governed Pakistan in the exact same way, where tactically he would get things done when he wanted to, like the raid on the Lal Masjid, the extremist masjid that was operating in Islamabad. He carried that out very well, almost brilliantly, but it wasn't part of a longer-term strategy for implementing any sort of change or defeating the people who were trying to kill him and are fighting against U.S. troops. So he's governed in that exact way. Tactically, he's been quite good. Strategically, there's been nothing whatsoever to think he has a long-term vision other than surviving any given day.
One of the things, Devi, that the U.S. has proposed in order to protect its own interests in Afghanistan, as well as the people of Afghanistan, is to fence the border along those hundreds of miles. But Hamid Karzai, the president of Afghanistan, has opposed this pretty strongly. Can you talk about the disputed parts of the border and what that would mean?
Well, you have a very porous border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. One of the reasons that it's so easy for militants in Pakistan to come into Afghanistan and carry out attacks against coalition forces there is precisely because of the porous border. The tribes also, it's not just militants who take advantage of this. There are tribes that don't really consider themselves part of one or the other. This is the area that they live in, and they don't care where one border ends and the other border begins. I think that Karzai is probably my best take on this is that Karzai is concerned about tribes whose way of life would be disrupted by this border fence. Look, certainly Karzai is extremely concerned about the rise of militancy within Pakistan and the safe haven in Pakistan. He's made a lot of noise about this. But I think that it's wise to take his concerns very seriously because, frankly, he knows the area and he knows the culture a lot better than the U.S. planners do.
So there's not, it wouldn't be worth it. I mean, it makes sense that he's concerned about, I guess the Pashtuns are one of the largest tribes that sort of crosses
right.
both sides. And obviously he's concerned about their culture and the way they live. But you don't think that he's mostly motivated by a desire to make sure that when the border is finally delineated, that the disputed territories would go to Afghanistan?
Look, that may be part of it. And if so, I'm not as, I'm clearly not as sympathetic to those concerns. But this is an issue that I haven't had the opportunity to fully vet in terms of whether it would be a good idea to wall it off or not. But as I said, I think that it is, and certainly if you look at Israel and the wall that it erected, although that wall was very controversial, you can see the results in terms of a decrease in suicide bombings in Israel. Likewise, if you could successfully erect a fence between Afghanistan and Pakistan and reduce the incidence of cross-border attacks, that would be fantastic. I'm not saying that I stand with Karzai and I'm against such a border. What I am saying is I would certainly give some weight to his concerns because sometimes there are things in Afghanistan and other places that the U.S. just ends up overlooking because of its lack of knowledge about the local culture and the like. If it turns out that what Karzai is motivated by is simply his own land disputes with Pakistan, then I would prioritize that far, far below protecting U.S. troops and protecting as well Afghan civilians.
You talked earlier about President Bush having looked Pervez Musharraf in the eye and believed him that, in fact, al-Qaeda and the Taliban would be pulled back by the actions that he took. Do you think, is it reasonable to assume that Musharraf is doing everything he can to really eliminate those forces in his own country, or should we be suspicious and assume that perhaps a lot more Pakistanis are providing aid and comfort to these groups?
I think it's clear that Musharraf is not doing everything that he can, nor is the new parliament doing everything that they can. One thing that is important to note is that Pakistan is dealing with multiple crises right now. During this conversation, we've been focusing on the rise of Islamic extremism and militancy in Pakistan. But another major problem that Pakistan faces is the collapse of its economy. Like everywhere else in the world, Pakistan is experiencing enormous food price inflation. The price of basic goods has gone up, and people are having a hard time putting food on their table. Right now, to the average Pakistani, economic concerns trumpet any of the concerns that we're talking about. Now, as to Musharraf and what he's doing, it's been obvious for a long time that he wasn't doing everything he could, nor was he really governing effectively. I talked before about Musharraf being a brilliant tactician but a lousy strategist. He's never manifested a strategy to actually confront the forces of militancy in his country. Instead, it seems like often the Pakistani politicians, including Musharraf, want to shunt this issue down the road as much as possible. To me, that's what the peace treaties have been. Musharraf lost a lot of men in trying to flush al-Qaeda out of the tribal areas after their attempts to kill him. Given all of the military losses that he incurred, he wanted to make it seem as though he was doing something, while at the same time realizing that his options for actually doing anything were limited. Thus, you get peace treaties, after which Musharraf is able to assert that he's dealt with this problem, when the problem was anything but dealt with. Likewise, that's happening again now. With the new parliament, which rode into power on a wave of anti-American sentiment, often tying Musharraf to the United States, painting him as a U.S. puppet, they've also discussed the issue of militancy, and their policy is more of the same, but much, much more of the same. Since you've had the new parliament come into power, talks have opened up with virtually every militant outfit in the country, and you've had seven separate treaties signed, encompassing nine districts in Pakistan. Now, negotiations aren't necessarily a bad thing. I don't have a theological pre-commitment against negotiations. The problem is, what are you getting out of the negotiations? And as I've said when we first started talking about the current round of negotiations, they look a lot like the Waziristan Accords. These are negotiations in which there's no reason to believe that the forces of militancy are going to decline post-treaty. And in fact, there's evidence to the contrary, because you can see an increase in the incidences of attacks into Afghanistan. You know, for a lot of Americans, the recent attack in Afghanistan's Nuristan province, where a U.S. base was almost overrun by insurgents and where 9 U.S. soldiers died, has come to represent the increasing problems of the Afghan war. And you've had a number of different attacks like that along the Afghan border that are emblematic of the fact that not only is al-Qaeda and the Taliban regenerating in Pakistan, but that you have a porous border and they're able to carry out attacks. They've done so in the provinces of Zabul, Paktika, Paktia, Nangarhar, and Kunar, all of which sit along the border with Pakistan.
Do you agree, David, with the assessments that the Taliban and al-Qaeda both in Pakistan are stronger than they were before 9/11?
I don't know about stronger than before 9/11. That's a very difficult thing to assess. A major piece of evidence to the contrary would be you don't see as many terror plots as before 9/11. But I would say that they're close to the same level. I mean, they definitely have had a rebound. Last year in Waziristan, there were 29 terrorist training camps. This year in Waziristan and the tribal areas, there are about 100. Now, not all of these are permanent. Some of them are temporary. Some of them are small and located in a mosque or a madrasa. But you have a massive increase in the amount of terrorist training camps. I mean, one advantage to having this network of camps in Pakistan as opposed to Afghanistan is that less travel is involved to go to Pakistan. Previously, when you had al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and their camps there, when someone wanted to go train in an al-Qaeda camp, they'd have to travel into Pakistan, sometimes hook up with a front organization, and then travel from Pakistan into Afghanistan. This has really cut down the travel time.
My guest is David Gartenstein-Ross. He's Vice President of Research, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. We'll return to our discussion in just a moment. If you want to read his article, you can go online to the Weekly Standard. It's called A Dangerous Neighbor, How Pakistan's Deterioration Harms Afghanistan. We'll be back in just a moment. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Gartenstein-Ross. We're talking about his article in the Weekly Standard, which is called A Dangerous Neighbor, How Pakistan's Deterioration Harms Afghanistan. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Jonathan in Gainesville. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. I had a quick comment in that you may or may not agree that Pakistan in and of itself, being a recent political creation with the breakup of India and such, is not a nation to look at lasting because it's based on basically a common religion. And if you have any reformation to that religion, just like Christians splitting apart during their reformation, you witness the breakdown of that entire secular unit as well. But that's just my comment. My question is, if we clearly identify beyond the shadow of a doubt, a significant terrorist present in Pakistan, kind of like when Obama was asked the question, would you, and he made the comment, I'll strike into Pakistan. When we cross it, well, should we cross into that sovereign territory to clearly and directly take out a terrorist threat if we know it's there for a fact? I have no ambiguous situation.
Well, thanks, Jonathan, for your question and comment. To address the question first, my answer is absolutely. If you clearly identify a terrorist target, you do strike it. And, in fact, that's what we've done. Recently, a top bomb maker, a top al-Qaeda bomb maker named Abu Khabab, was killed in Pakistan. He was killed by a U.S. airstrike. We've carried out a number of airstrikes there against top terrorist targets. Generally, the modus operandi is that Pakistan will claim credit for what the U.S. had done in order to minimize public backlash against it. There's a limit to how massive any sort of U.S. incursion should be. We're very cognizant of Pakistan's instability, and there is a real possibility that if the U.S. were to launch a massive counterinsurgency operation or a massive aerial bombing campaign, that it could destabilize and ultimately topple the government. But constrained pinprick airstrikes against clear terrorist targets, yes, that's something we should do. It's something that we have been doing, and it's something that we'll continue to do. As for your comment, I actually want to address that, because I agree with what you said, that Pakistan is not really a nation. The PAKI in Pakistan, it's actually an acronym for a number of the different groups that are thrown in under the nation state. And actually, one of the reasons why you have so much militancy in the tribal areas is because of Pakistani governmental policies. One of the things the central government decided very early on is that the tribes didn't have enough connection to the Pakistani nation state. So they had a deliberate policy of injecting more and more religion into the tribal areas. Unfortunately, one of the side effects of the policy that they undertook is that you had a lot of people in the tribal areas who've tilted in a much more militant direction in their understanding of the faith. So in some cases, the problems that we're now experiencing are a product of what you put your finger on, of Pakistan not really being a nation state in the way that we normally think of the concept.
Officially, though, isn't Pakistan a secular government?
That's difficult to say. Pakistan has a blasphemy law, for example. And normally when a government is secular, it doesn't have a blasphemy law. For a lot of Islamic states, that's a difficult question to answer. Egypt is officially secular, but you have a large amount of aspects of Sharia law that are incorporated into the civil code. There are other Islamic states where the constitution makes Islam the official religion, but you don't have that reflected at all in the laws of the state. So with Pakistan, I think that officially aside, it's a difficult question to answer whether it is indeed a secular state. There certainly is evidence to the contrary.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. David Gartenstein-Ross. Gartenstein-Ross is Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Let's go next to Joe in Dallas. Hi, Joe.
Hi. It seems your guest has a rather profound approach to this problem, so I'm daring to ask this question. Richard Brooks had an interesting column this morning in the New York Times where he points out that if you ask a Chinese person looking at a fishbowl, he'll talk about the bowl and the combination of the fish in the bowl, where if you ask an American, he'll comment on the biggest fish in the bowl. The point he's trying to make is that different cultures have different perceptions of reality, and that is what makes for the difficulty in their getting along. And we're in the Mideast, we're trying to effect a reconciliation between the West and Islam. And the problem is various commentators, including the head of the country that's next to Palestine, said the antagonism between the West and Islam is constantly growing and growing. And you talked about the number of religious schools in Pakistan. Do you see any forces at work in the Mideast that are recommending a path that will lessen this antagonism rather than increasing it? I sort of apologize for that question. It's a desperate situation.
I think that's actually an excellent question. And one thing I would point to that addresses it is a project that's being undertaken in Jordan called the Amman Message. What the Amman Message is, it's heavily sponsored by the Jordanian government, and they've gotten Islamic scholars together from all four of the madhabs, that is, all four of the major schools of Sunni jurisprudence, from the major schools of Shia jurisprudence, and also from some of the lesser-known sects, such as the Ismailis, the Abadis, and the Zaydis. So they have this wide swath of Islamic jurisprudence together to try to address some of those major issues where there is conflict between the Islamic world and the West. And one of the precepts of this is talked about in an introduction to their very first consensus document on the concept of takfir, or casting those out of Islam. One of the precepts behind the project is that there are indeed certain areas where the West can ask something of Islam. And the areas they outline are the law of war, the loyalty of Muslims to the state in which they live, religious freedom, gender discrimination, and a few other areas. Now, this project actually shows both some of the promise and some of the limitations of what they're trying to undertake. In terms of the promise, they've come up with some very good consensus documents signed by a large number of very respected theologians, people who have substantial followings. It also is beneficial in that it brings together all these people from different schools. And part of the message of having all these different people together is that they're all Muslim, despite the doctrinal differences between them. In terms of the limitations, those can be seen, for example, in their latest attempts, not published yet, but their latest attempts to formulate a consensus document on the Islamic law of war, where even though they're very critical of al-Qaeda, there are exceptions that basically you can drive a truck through, which make clear that there's no condemnation of attacks on coalition forces in Iraq, no condemnation of suicide bombings against Israeli civilians, for example. Things like that are reflected through as some of the shortcomings of trying to forge a consensus. But I would say that something like the Amman message is important and is one of those attempts to deal religiously with these very prickly issues that do, as you said, affect the relationship today between the Islamic world and the Western world.
While we have you with us, David, I'd like to move the conversation a few hundred miles northwest to the Caucasus. We heard this morning that President Medvedev of Russia has called for an end to the firing and the fighting there while they figure out what's going on. I'm looking here at my globe, and I look at Georgia, which looks to be about 1% of the landmass of Russia. What are the chances that this argument over this disputed area could spiral into something that brought in more of the Balkan states?
I think that there is a substantial chance of it, although not via this incursion. I think that part of what Russia is doing is this is a test to see how the rest of the world is going to respond. Right now, the U.S., as everyone knows, is bogged down in Afghanistan and Iraq. The European countries are completely dependent upon Russia and other oil-exporting countries to tend to their basic supplies and to keep their economy afloat. And this had been planned for some time. There's no question about that. And more of this will come out over the next several weeks. But Russia was likely planning this for about a year. And the U.S. intelligence community missed the entire Russian mobilization. I think it's highly likely that the fact that they missed this is going to go down as one of those major U.S. intelligence community failures, where they should have seen it coming, and they simply didn't. Right now, even though Medvedev says that the military operations are over, I think it's unlikely. They said a large number of times during the Chechen War that their operations in Chechnya were almost over or had wrapped up. They have a manifest reason to say that they're ending those operations, which is that Sarkozy is over in Russia now trying to resolve this conflict and bring it to a resolution. One thing that Russia did in going into Georgia, which, by the way, had been a part of Russia until 1991, but one of the things they did is they also sent a diplomatic cable to various European capitals that placed a list of conditions on what the European countries should not do. For example, you won't support anything, you won't do anything more than lightly condemn our actions, you won't offer anything more than humanitarian support, you won't provide any military assistance. And Russia warned that failure to comply would result in them yanking the fuel from these European countries. So it's a situation where this cannot be described as anything but naked aggression, in my view. They've gone into a sovereign country and are trying to overthrow the government of this country without any sort of lead-up, any sort of real provocation. The incident that Russia claimed was really their cause for war was in one of the breakaway republics. You had an attack where the separatists claimed that Georgia had killed six people. Now, when you compare an attack that kills six people, bad that that may be, this was in, incidentally, South Ossetia. When Georgia has killed six people, that pales in comparison to, for example, the Russian treatment of Grozny, where they leveled the entire city during their incursion into Chechnya. So I think we have to deal with two facts moving forward. One is that you do have a revamped Russia, one that, like the czars before them, like the Soviet Union, has expansionist impulses. We've seen Russia assassinate someone in London. We've seen them try to poison the president of the Ukraine. So it's not like this is something that is suddenly out of character. But now we have to deal with that new fact. A second thing that we really need to understand moving forward is that the oil weapon is again in play. Russia is threatening European capitals with their access to oil markets. Suddenly with India and China and their burgeoning middle classes, there's a lot more worldwide demand for oil. So we may see oil being used as a tool of diplomacy and a tool of politics in a way that it hasn't been since the 1973 to 74 Arab oil embargo against the United States. And this, in my view, places a great deal of urgency on the need to develop alternatives to oil.
Yeah, and we should say that the strategic importance of Georgia is that based on its geographic location, it is sort of right in place to have a pipeline that takes oil from Russia to the West and to Asia.
Right, and it already has the BTC pipeline. So it's kind of a perfect storm for Russia. Not only were they concerned about Georgia's pro-West leanings, it's the most pro-American country easily in that region, not only were they concerned that it had just been admitted into NATO, but also, you know, in terms of the politics of energy, it's an excellent country for Russia to control again. Perfect storm.
So you have the United States, in this instance, waiting for the UN Security Council to rule on what ought to be done. What do you think the U.S. can do? It seems that a lot of Georgians would have expected the U.S. to come to its rescue immediately, and that doesn't appear to be happening.
Well, we certainly don't have a good record of standing behind our allies. And make no mistake, Georgia is a U.S. ally. I think that there are things that we could have done several days ago. I think at this point there's not much we can do. This gets back to what I talked about, you know, when we were discussing Pakistan, which is muscular diplomacy. We don't really have much of a military option here, although there's been some whisperings about a military option involving NATO. I'm not going to get into that, but I will just say that there have been some whisperings about a military option, not a U.S. invasion, but involving some other areas that Russia lays claim to. This is an area where, you know, jumping on this early on, taking all available diplomatic measures, trying to internationalize the conflict through institutions like the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, setting up talks right away in a neutral forum, those are the kind of things that at least could have kept the Georgian state alive. Now, hopefully Georgia will survive this, but I think we have to recognize at this point that there's a significant chance that Russia will actually push for reincorporation of Georgia into the Russian state. You already have a puppet faction in Georgia emerging that is arguing for reincorporation into Russia.
David Gartenstein-Ross is Vice President of Research at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. You can read his weekly Standard article, A Dangerous Neighbor, online. David, thanks so much for spending the hour with us.
It is always a pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening. Have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.